If it were not this way, we would soon have no cosmos. This is why we sometimes have the deep and acute intuition that we are accomplishing absolutely nothing, and no matter how hard we try, we can't overcome what we call inertia. Actually, somewhere in the world, other pieces of the puzzle must work out their paths so that we can join them. There is no other viable way to handle these things. It's one endless series of D-Days, with each piece perfectly synchronized. But oh, the waiting until our moment to fire effectively, in an important manner, arrives. Perhaps the most startling aspect of reality that I saw, and one which for nearly 9 months I could not fully accept, was this. The only portion of the universe which is truly real is living creatures such as ourselves. The non-living parts are merely structure, very much like the backdrop and artificial scenery in a formal play. We see these dead objects in terms of being as real as ourselves. But again, this is a necessary illusion or delusion placed on us in order that we be able to function in what we must do, which is to grow and develop according to complex plans obscured from our gaze. What exists around us, actually, beyond and above the sparks of life which we ourselves are, is in essence nothing more than elaborate but somewhat barren struts and support beams, literally so. They support the intricate signaling devices which flash messages, i.e. commands and assistance, to us continually. And also, of course, they afford biologically essential life support. This is indeed a kind of ship we are within, but in shape more like a gigantic hollow cube, all sides of which surround us and fire information and instructions in rapid, elaborate sequence. We are seeing the physical body of the Creator who animates all. What I could not see, and remember, I didn't reason all this out, I saw it noetically, was the final goal or purpose of all this. That was beyond my ken. I saw a process, what seemed to be a temporary mode which we inhabited. I sensed that this is a stage from which we go to another, see previous letters. We are being processed along, and as we go, we are changed and informed. There is no ontology for us, no concrete being. It is all, as Bergson saw, a becoming. We are, in a way, passing through a cosmic car wash, and a thousand brushes and brooms and vacuum cleaners are scrubbing us, refining us and purifying us, and, very important, teaching us. This process, along which we all travel in unison, produces what seemed to me permanent alterations in us, by us, of course. I don't mean our physical bodies, but the spark inhabiting these bodies. But also, we seem to be carrying out, at the bidding of these engrammings, complex tasks, which is why people often get a sense of God's divine plan of which they are a part. It seemed to me that in addition to being changed, we are working our asses off in the service of some overall structure, purpose, goal, or need. Perhaps what I saw is continual creation, and we are involuntary workmen located here and there like a million bees about the structure, hammering and sawing for all we are worth, the blueprint not being visible to us, but only to the architect. Our instructions are somehow within our heads. I have the keen intuition, probably a correct one, that our original set of engramming, the many programs laid down and then inhibited at birth, are continually being updated and refined during sleep. While each of us sleeps, he is taught through the dream state. It never seems to occur to people, by and large, why it is that universally mankind has sensed that dreams deal with the future. The reason is obvious. It is in the future that the tasks which the dreams inform us about are to take place. Also, I'm positive, the night's dreams reinforce original training vis-a-vis the disinhibiting signals about to be encountered. Shortly, a day or so, a week maybe at the most, before you run into a particular ad showing canned tuna fish with a drawing of a pretty girl, to which you are to respond with a complex series of acts. You will have a dream, only vaguely remembered, that by reiterating the original training eliminates any possibility that you will not respond when the signal from your environment comes your way. As you and I know from reading SF stories, one signal missed and an entire alternate universe would come into being. Hardly an economical or orderly way for God to handle things. You'll find early stories of mine, such as Adjustment Team and The Commuter, dealing with post-screw-up changes. They're always bad news to the Creator. In connection with this thought, I submit to you that this entire cosmology which I've presented to you in these pages bears an organic relationship to my entire body of writing, to my basic theme of what is reality. I think I have at last transliminated, i.e., coughed up into consciousness, my subcontinent, which has given rise to all my work and to all my theories and thinking. Note: 2374 marks a turning point away from Dick questioning the nature of reality in his fiction, but without providing unambiguous answers, and toward generating an astonishing efflorescence of theories that do not merely question, but instead make assertions about the nature of reality. The drive of his theorizing in the exegesis seems always to be toward incorporating more and more ideas into a single synthetic scheme, without definitively eliminating or disqualifying any one of them. Not surprisingly, then, the synthesis grows wilder and more ideationally unstable as he proceeds. NKH. End note. You are the first, and so far only person I've told it to. I hope you're not displeased. Cordially, Phil Dick. Letter to Claudia Bush, February 13th, 1975. 4163. Dear Claudia, it seems to me that one of the most important points that Angus Taylor makes about my preoccupation with just how real is reality. Note: Angus Taylor was the author of the 1973 pamphlet Philip K. Dick and the Umbrella of Light, an early critical analysis of Dick's work and its religious concerns. End note. Is that one cannot sense that reality is somehow insubstantial unless somehow, unconsciously, one is comparing or contrasting that reality with a kind of hyperreality. Otherwise, the intuition makes no sense. This shows how inexpert I have been regarding my own epistemological perceptions. What over the years I have seen and put into my writing, I have judged correctly. The soap bubble effect, so to speak, of the phenomenological world. I knew what it indicated about the world around me. Something lay beyond it, or something had constructed it as a kind of set or backdrop or stage, which we all take to be real. But there it is again, the word real. If nothing else existed, no other universe, no other order of reality, then however insubstantial, even if dreamlike, the world we see would by definition have to be given the name of the real. It can only be less than real if something which is not less than real exists, and presumably in some true sense behind what we do actually see. Note: in Dick's stories, amid all the anxiety over disintegrating universes and unstable realities, there is always the sense of an ultimate reality underlying the fakery. The absolute shines through the cracks in the walls of the universe, and the hand of God, or Ubik, or the Walker on Earth, or Wilbur Mercer, reaches through to help us. This is Dick's basic ontological faith. Contrary to appearances, something is actually real. Whether that something is comprehensible to the human intellect is another question entirely. But even in this doubt, Dick can be located in the tradition of apophatic mystics like Meister Eckhart or the anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing, G.M. End note. This realization seems to have surfaced now and then in my writing without me seeing anything more than a theoretical need to provide it for my characters to discuss with one another what they saw, their insights about what they saw, what it all meant. And yet, as I said in my long metaphysical paper, what is true for one universe is true for all universes. If these insights are true for the fictional universes of my novels, then, unless I am fundamentally wrong in regard to perceiving the soap bubble manufactured stage backdrop effect around me, the further premise, or rather the most significant deduction from the premise of less than reality, must pertain to our universe, the one all of us are living in this very day. That I never saw that all this had to apply to our world is a measure of the failure of the artist to discover the relationship between his art, or in my case, the worlds within my art, the topic of my art, and life, his life, all our lives, our world. The first philosopher to prove beyond doubt that what our senses perceive as the real world cannot in actuality be real, not probably isn't, but cannot, was Parmenides. He also realized that this did not tell him, by any known process, what in its stead was real. He could prove only negatives, which we're told can't be done. He did this very thing and went his way. I think that in my writing, I retraced the ground which he traced and came to the same conclusions. But I had the advantage of knowing in the back of my mind, i.e., my unconscious or right hemisphere, about Plato's concept of the idea universe, of which ours is a mirror reflection. You can see that Plato's whole concept was dictated by what Parmenides did somewhat before him, if not dictated by a priori necessity, then sooner or later by existential experience, as in my case. I speak of my March 1974 experience. The criticism, which I remember using in Philosophy 10A, a survey course at Cal, was that what value does this metaphysical, eternal, real world of forms of Plato have, since we can never encounter or experience it? Doesn't pragmatism show us that it is unnecessary to believe in it? All events can be explained just as well without it. What I didn't know was that after Plato's time, the Platonists and Neoplatonists developed methods of encountering that very real world of the logos or archetypes, the plan. This is probably the best English rendering of logos, underlying all phenomena. Once they had begun to experience it, as I did quite by chance in March 1974, they really put an end to such bickering as I engaged in back in my college days. It is an index of the ignorance of our world today that my instructor's answer was not, but later on for 800 years, people did experience Plato's world of the idea, but rather was that if I was going to question all this, I should quit the class. I did so. I wonder what the ghost of Socrates would have thought when the instructor's response was as it was. Note. Here Dick pointedly reflects on being a student in a philosophy class whose instructor dogmatically insisted that Plato's world of forms was no longer intelligible or useful to us. In the face of this intolerance, Dick rightly quit the class, and, soon enough, the university. Dick is evidently not an academic or professional philosopher, but an amateur, or perhaps that most splendid of things, what Eric Davis calls a garage philosopher. As someone who gets paid to teach philosophy for a living, I find Dick compelling as a philosopher because whatever he lacks in scholarly rigor, he more than makes up for in powers of imagination and in rich lateral and cumulative associations. Indeed, if one defines a philosopher along the lines offered by Deleuze and Guattari, namely, as someone who creates concepts, then Dick is a philosopher. The naivete of Dick's approach to philosophy, like his use of secondary sources like Encyclopedia Britannica and Paul Edwards' fantastically useful Encyclopedia of Philosophy, permits a rapidity of association and lends a certain systematic coherence to his concerns. If Dick had known more, it might have led to him producing less interesting chains of ideas. SC. End note. That for years, about 20, I have alluded to the possibility of the entire Platonist system being accurate, and that eventually, without premeditation, I actually experienced that universe lying behind ours, concealed within, yes, actually concealed within ours, is a point of importance in the constructing of a new worldview to replace the old one, which is shabby and cracking apart and fading away. This is why the various Marxist intellectuals have been coming here, writing about Ubik, discussing Empedocles vis-à-vis my writing. If I have, and indeed I have, stumbled independently onto Platonism without knowing what it is or what that stumbling upon, that refinding after so many centuries signifies, then of course I have done something of importance, but not something original. It's as if the formula for Coca-Cola were lost for centuries, and then someone invented a soft drink, began bottling and selling it, and an incredibly old man, Mel Brooks maybe, tasted it and shouted, "This is Coca-Cola! I remember it from the 20th century." Imagine how disappointed the new inventor would be, personally, although probably the world would rejoice that Coke had been found again, resurrected from the trash of the gutter, etc., as Lem would put it, no doubt. A hideous power buried for eons in the form of degenerate molecules. However, it would be striking to meditate on the meaning of all this if a large part of the intellectual community had decided, for almost 400 years straight, that Coca-Cola had never existed, that those in the dim past had only imagined it to be a part of their world. To reinvent or rediscover something which had been ruled non-existent in the first place, that is the secret weapon of truth. It can't be suppressed, because of its nature, if it could be, it would be only opinion. In a very important way, this is how we define truth. People keep bumbling across it again and again. It survives even its own total destruction. Just as the power of Christianity lay not in the crucifixion, but in the resurrection. If Barabbas had returned instead of Jesus, we would now be Barabbasians, I guess. Then the same can be said for this, which I think can properly and precisely be termed Neoplatonism. By the way, our New Britannica defines Neoplatonism as the sum total of all pagan, i.e. non-Christian, Western theological and philosophical thought, rather than a particular doctrine or sect. Wow! It was around the year 500 AD that Justinian closed all the schools which taught Neoplatonism, i.e., he forbade its teaching. He outlawed it. Golly, I have brought down Christianity then. I have proved what Ted Sturgeon said in that Venus Plus 10, or whatever he called that ace book. The church kicked the asses of those who were right and sold 2,000 years of profitable lies in the place of what I am sure now was not only real and true, but what they knew was real and true. Vide, what became of Origina? How is the Pope going to take this? As popes always have, by kicking someone's ass. But in truth, in very truth, this is a shadow universe we see, a reflection in the mirror of another universe behind it. And that other universe can be reached by an individual directly without the help of any priest or service or communion or even knowing what he is doing. The latter pertains to me, you understand. I was just trying out the massive hits of WS vitamins. God is as close as the wall beside me, is within the wall beside me, concealed by it, as if that wall is a paper mask. The workman is invisible within the workshop. A Sufi saying, which to me says it all. The Sufis would point out too, that you and I, we are portions of the workshop, not outside it, somewhere gazing at it from an external standpoint. When you ponder this, you begin to understand, and the invisible body of God, the kingdom or garden, begins to grow and to blossom, not only around you, but in you. Note. Here Dick ponders the notion of the kingdom found in Luke 17, alongside a Sufi insight. In Luke 17:20, Jesus tells the Pharisees that the kingdom of God cometh not with observation. In other words, the kingdom of heaven cannot be found by inspecting empirical reality or by watching for signs of its imminent arrival. So too in the Vedic tradition, one finds the practice of neti-neti, which looks at the world and recalls, over and over, that the divine is not this, not this. In Luke 17:21, Jesus follows his first negation with another. Neither shall they say, "Lo here," or "Lo there." In other words, the kingdom of heaven is neither here nor there, precisely because it is not the spatial external world. Being neither here nor there, the kingdom is what Dick would describe as ubiquitous. Hence, Jesus then asks us to behold, to look with awareness. For behold, the kingdom of God is within you. We are directed to behold what St. Teresa called our interior castle, our consciousness, the virtual space of contemplation. If we follow William Penn and look within, we find in the contemplative tradition Dick is writing in and through that within and without form a unity. R.D. End note. One thing that is a great relief to me is that since all this was known for 1,000 years, I don't have to convince the world of it, and even if they come in and set fire to my typewriter and chop me up into dog food, this realization will reemerge for the reasons I gave. And to even further ease my burden, I've evidently said it in my novels and stories, well enough anyhow for old Angus and other astute types like yourself to discern. The time bomb of awakening is already ticking away. We shall wake up, are doing so now. The basic scientific discovery of my vast metaphysic, which I had written you about, was my postulation of two times at right angles to each other, which I called vertical, which we normally perceive, and horizontal, which is the axis along which the objects in Ubik regress. Now I have the New Britannica, and in looking up the article on time, I find that, yes, indeed, it is speculated now that besides the regular time, there may be a hypertime, which would be orthogonal, a word I didn't know. I looked it up, and sure enough, it means at right angles. Also, someone, Kurt Gödel, I think the Britannica article said. Note. Kurt Gödel, 1906 to 1978, was an Austrian mathematician most famous for his two incompleteness theorems. End note. Speculated that the orthogonal time might be curved, since time and space are regarded now as integral, and space does curve. This hypertime would curve back onto itself, and hello Gracie Slick and hyperdrive. The world of trash, e.g. SF and rock, has done did it. The article said that it remains speculation, this orthogonal time. Not for me is it, nor was it for Plotinus. So although I have discovered and invented nothing, which is mu in Chinese, and considered priceless. Note. Mu is Japanese for not or nothing, and is featured in the opening case of the Zen Koan collection, The Gateless Barrier. Wu is its Chinese equivalent. End note. I have at least found something. The trash, to fuse Lem and Jesus as coiners of metaphor, of great price, for which a man sells all he has that he may acquire it.